This is an example of speech.
All our history of broiling wars ain't deep on even.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, expletive deleted, details expanded, educated yet speculative, often evergreen, topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. I'm Peter Albro. You can contact me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis, and I have with me, as always and forever, my friend Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at green_weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Weak Thoughts, a crash course in government deficit, a hip-hop test drive of Evidence's new album Whether or Not, and of course, much more. Prepare to get riled up and righteous. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some weak thoughts.
Decision signed with a shake and a squirt. Centralized states get turned a blind eye. Those who benefit never ask why.
All right. Sure, we have some weak thoughts. Charles, how are you doing?
A little tired this morning. How are you?
It's morning time, so I'm grumpy and ornery. Short of temper, and especially like you wake up, you have your coffee, and you like open up Twitter, and you're like, "Fuck!"
Today's the state of the union. At least people are already talking about their drinking games.
Yeah, I was actually going to look up some of those tonight. I had a thought last night, which was, I wonder when the first State of the Union drinking game was held.
Mm-hmm. Well, I assume it was just drinking and eventually turned into a game.
Yeah.
When people started drinking less.
Yeah, I mean, with the dawning of the internet and with how terrible W was as a president, I know at least they were happening then.
Wait, didn't we have one in like 2005 or 6?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Somewhere in his second term. So full disclosure, we're recording this before the State of the Union, but you'll be hearing this out there, everyone, after the State of the Union, of course. So instead of predictions, we're going to have reactions. what's your initial reaction to the State of the Union, Charles?
Well, I didn't expect him to announce the legalization of weed or the strengthening of capital markets, but it's a pleasant surprise.
Oh, yeah. I was really taken aback by all of the arrests that occurred during the speech of political opponents and media members. It was very Saddam Hussein like. And I will say then my reaction to the reaction is the media doesn't seem too upset about it. Van Jones said it was presidential. So.
I think they said that at MSNBC, too.
It's sort of like third world presidential, but what else happened during the speech?
Ginsburg announced a resistance cell, an underground movement.
Yeah. I couldn't help but notice how Paul Ryan was just Paul Ryan.
Just sitting back there counting money?
Yeah, just smiling and clapping like the dullard he is.
Mike Pence?
Mike Pence wasn't there because there were women in the audience, so he didn't.
No, his wife is probably there. It wasn't. It's okay.
Oh yeah, okay. I mean, what is that? Is there like a spatial thing though with his rules? I mean, like, why is it okay if she's 500 feet away? I mean, couldn't there be an intern somewhere near him that tries to seduce him during the speech?
Well, I think it's a private meeting. I don't think it's ever been. I don't think she followed him in, like, his office, hopefully.
Does he have an all-male staff?
Man, I would assume not, but hey, maybe.
I mean, how could he have a female on his staff? I mean, his wife doesn't come to work with him, right? Huh. Right?
I assume not.
I don't know. other reactions to the speech. You know, it was, I can't say I'm too surprised that he declared 5 new wars. That was...
And in our alliance, our new alliance with Russia.
Yes. So, that's a good transition into some of the news over the past couple days. Shortly before midnight last night, the Trump administration released this list of all the oligarchs of Russia that they are apparently not sanctioning, is the way I took it. They're like, here's the list of people we would sanction, but we don't want to sanction them. Yeah, so I've seen, like just now, Claire McCaskill is a little pissed about this. Of course, the Republicans are silent, even though they all fucking voted for it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for those who don't know, probably the most bipartisan bill passed in recent memory, at least in the past year, was Russian sanctions, sanctioning of Putin administration figures and some of their, quote, oligarchs there. And it was in response to their election meddling. It got nearly unanimous in both the House and Senate, which is, like, unheard of, especially the House. I mean, come on.
Yeah, Russia bashing is real easy politically.
You'd think there would have been 20 of the Republicans there that would have not voted for it just because a Democrat did, or vice versa. So, I don't know.
That seems reasonable.
But yeah, they almost all voted for it, and the Trump administration said that they don't need to do it because the threat of them is doing enough. Which, once they said that, doesn't that take the threat away? I don't really understand. I mean, I think targeted sanctions in general against corrupt regimes is a good idea, I think. And especially in this case.
Right, it kept Mugabe squirming all those years.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about in a previous episode how a lot of the sanctions against Iran over the years have not been targeted sanctions.
Nope, and that, blanket sanctions.
And that, you know, those don't really hinder the corrupt elements in those governments. So, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with this. I don't think he'll address the sanctions issue, even though he's talking to all of the people who voted for it.
I would bet that he doesn't even mention Russia during the speech.
Well, so I saw... Well, wait, these are reactions.
Sorry.
How can I phrase this? Yeah. No. I saw something that said in, you know, something leaked. Because, you know, they write the speech and then they selectively leak parts to the media. In fact, they usually just give it to the media a few hours before so that the pre-show analysis talks about the speech. It's really fucking weird. There's no surprises anymore. Then they've been doing this for years, of course. But that he says something, he calls for an end to the Mueller investigation, which the reaction to that will be, was
besides resounding laughter from one half of the house.
Yeah, and then the Republicans all got up and ran out of the room and actually physically mobbed Mueller's office. So that was fun.
I thought they were fighting with the FBI agents who were trying to arrest him. I mean, you can't commit obstruction of justice in front of the entire country and get away with it, right?
I'm pretty sure this administration is proving that idea wrong. That's like their main policy. It's like...
keep Trump safe.
You know, like in the Fire and Fury book Dina asked Kushner, well, what are the policy objectives of the administration? And he's like, I'll get back to you. When he did get back to her, it was like obstruction of justice, racism, and I don't know what the third one was.
Kleptocracy.
Yeah. Kleptocracy. Subsection, whatever Putin says. There were some changes in the continuing resolution passed by Congress for the budget a week or two ago.
Yeah, I feel sorry about that. I know I mentioned it on Twitter before last week's episode, but I forgot to talk about it here. So under the continuing resolution, the Senate, and, well, I guess was it the Senate? It must have been the House Intelligence Committee, inserted a provision.
It was the House, because it was Nunes was behind it, I believe.
Of course it was.
Go ahead.
So there was a provision inserted into the continuing resolution that the administration could move money around amongst the intelligence budgets without any kind of oversight. Like, because of, you know, various problems that we've had with intelligence in the past 40 years, the individual intelligence agencies had to go to Congress to approve projects and ask for Congress to appropriate money into those projects. But now the administration probably, they can just start new programs by fiat and fund them with whatever money they have left over in the bank account.
Yeah, and that should not be something that the Congress is...
So there's
they're neutering their own oversight.
Right. Now there's literally no reason for the intelligence agencies to, like, go to Congress. Because there's no requirement for that oversight on their money anymore. Then, whatever. We'll show up once a quarter and give you our... The CIA is doing great this quarter. We didn't kill anyone. There were only... We didn't issue drone strikes, they were ice cream strikes.
Yeah, I mean, they always say that Congress's power is the power of the purse. And when you just give a unlimited, you know, no-limit credit card to an executive agency, then they don't have... I mean, what are they going to do now?
Apparently kill 8 times as many people in drone strikes as the previous administrations. Judging from the initial results.
Yeah, wasn't it something like they've done pretty much as much as in the
Obama
entire...
and Bush combined?
Which, you know, Obama had a big... I mean, I think... I've seen this criticism of the Obama administration using drones a lot, which I think is a very fair...
They're downright surgical compared to Trump.
Wasn't it just sort of the nature of the changing technology of war and just the nature of the war itself, that there would be more in Obama over Bush?
Yeah, I that's a fair point. I mean, it's not like those Reaper drones were purchased like on a whim and they were like, hey, check out this model plane that we can shoot missiles from. Like, no, those logistics change. Like, the appropriations take years and years.
Yeah.
So Bush put that in. But, you know, he could have, like, not used them.
Oh, no, yeah.
Just because you have a gun doesn't mean you have to take it out and shoot it.
Yeah, and I don't mean to say... Well, I guess what I'm saying is, to me it's a ridiculous thing to say that Obama was a more of a, like, murderous hawk in the war on terror than Bush was. Like, at worst, they're the same, and it's just the nature of the war itself changed.
Changed, yeah. Obama was way more circumspect than issuing blanket invasions, like... And he wanted to take a lead from the rear approach compared to Bush, where we didn't actually send, like, hundreds of thousands of troops and Marines into Libya when we invaded there. We left it to the people on the ground, and because of the various arms flows in and out of that country, there's been chaos since.
Well, and to your point about Trump, is that I think it's not so much an issue of... To me, you know, more drone strikes, like the quantity of the drone strikes, it's the quality of them, or lack
thereof. I think it's both. I think they have just genuinely been shooting more.
Okay, but you were saying how they're not as surgical.
No, I don't think so, because they're giving these commanders, like, free hands in Somalia, Afghanistan, ISIS, against Daesh.
And so that's how this is happening, right? It's not so much that... The people are sitting in the fucking situation room or whatever at the White House, and they're like, oh, whatever, just throw a pile of bombs at that village. It's that they're not making those decisions, and it's going down the ladder.
Right. Obama had his kill matrix with baseball cards with militant leaders' faces on them, but I don't think the Trump administration has nearly that much wherewithal to organize that.
Yeah, and so these are lower-level military officials.
Well, generals still, but lower-level than the president, to be fair.
Yeah.
Like, theater commanders and such.
Who are ordering these, and again, it's like... less oversight, and all you need is one without the scruples to not really give a shit about the civilian loss of life.
And if a high-ranking officer says it, it's less likely that the subsequent, you know, subordinate officers are going to have that much of a problem with it.
Or their leadership. Don't worry about it. Nothing will happen from up top.
Right. It's like, do whatever, and we're going to protect you. Which, to be fair, that should be the role of a good commander, but not when your troops are knowingly and willfully committing crimes.
Yeah, there's limits on that.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to back up your guys, of course, but you also should be keeping an eye on your guys and making sure they're not putting you in a tough situation to back them up about.
Yeah, to use an analogy from Generation Kill, you don't punish the guy who pulled the Iraqi Special Forces goon out of his spider hole. You arrest, or you punish the heck out of that company commander who decided to, you know, basically torture him briefly.
Yeah.
Before putting him in custody.
Well, I almost said documentary. It has that feel. that miniseries had, it actually really got into the complicated nature and the problematic nature of military leadership and decision making. That's pretty much what it was about, actually. I would argue that's the main thesis of it.
Exactly. That's why you don't see as many Iraqis. It's just all Marines.
And it's actually, you know, when I went into that, I'm like, Generation Kill, and there's like fucking Marine on the cover, and, you know, I like war movies like any other red-blooded American, but it's not really a war movie. I mean, it is. It's like, it's a war show, but it's not in any way traditional. There's not big firefights.
Well, you don't really the life of like, the Marines.
Like, almost no one fired a weapon most of the, I mean, a couple times. Nope. But
it's just the tedium and boredom that is the actual life of soldiers and Marines, which I think that's the only thing I've ever seen that actually portrayed it halfway decently.
Yeah, and you know, like all that driving around and just like their conversations, both about what they're doing and then trying to distract themselves as well. Mm-hmm. No, that's a great one. David Simon's Generation Kill on HBO. Yeah, I'm not going to say I like it more than The Wire, but actually pretty close.
I hadn't realized it, but yeah, that is a fair comparison. I think The Wire edges out because of it's
more expensive.
More faceted. Yeah. More expansive.
So you wanted to talk about, I think to finish up on weak thoughts with the Brazilian political situation? A little
quick it's with the news. Continuing chaos in Brazil. Luiz Ignacio Lula da Silva, the former president, had his corruption conviction upheld, which means he probably won't be able to run in their presidential elections later this year.
Is that by law?
Yeah, once you're a convicted felon, you can't run for office, or at least the presidency.
Huh. We don't have that law.
No. No, I don't think we do.
I don't think there's any laws like that here. I actually got in a little Twitter exchange, totally well-mannered as well, by the way, but about like voting for felons. It was like because of Chelsea Manning, but I don't think the conversation, it wasn't really about Chelsea Manning, but just someone said like, oh, I'd never vote for a felon. And I'm like, I could.
Well, first of all, she was convicted in military court.
Again, but though it's not really about Chelsea Manning, but like you can picture situations. I can picture a lot of convictions that, depending on the context and how the person, like what led to them committing the felony, what led to them getting caught, and then how do they react afterwards? What kind of person are they afterwards? I can picture situations in which I would totally vote for a felon.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It just, to me, that's not in and of itself, and it precludes you from being able to hold office. My other argument was like, how many fucking politicians have committed felonies and they just weren't caught?
To be honest, I think we should have somebody who's been to jail in office, because they'll have a real, like, so shall we say, personal narrative in their justice reform strategy.
I agree. Actually, I think it's, or at least maybe, like, how about some people on the staff of some of these politicians that have been incarcerated before.
Hmm. You Absolutely.
Know, I mean, there's a lot of activists that have been incarcerated. Not necessarily.
I know of my. I know of one person who I knew in college who made a lot of, shall we say, personal mistakes and rehabilitated himself, and his last I heard was working for the Democrats in Madison.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I think that's the exception rather than the norm.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Which party was Lula in?
He was part of the Workers' Party.
Okay. And they are not in power right now?
No, they are not.
Okay.
The previous president, she was pushed out of office, basically through a parliamentary coup.
Yeah.
And now we have, down there is Michel Temer, the world's most unpopular leader. I think he's got like 3 or 4% approval ratings.
Like, Congress is like, wow, there's someone less popular than us in the political world?
Yeah, and he's doing everything he can to basically eliminate all the great protections and social welfare programs that Lula instituted when he was president, which is why he's so insanely popular. Like, if he were able to run, he would probably win without a problem.
So, what was the nature of his corruption?
The allegations against him was that he took a house from some executives.
Okay.
That they, like, it was a construction company that bought a house and fixed it up, and they, but there's no transfer of the deed into his name. He and his wife, like, apparently toured it once, because they have pictures of him and there with an executive, but there's no evidence that he ever actually lived there. It's,
and well, it's not in his name?
No.
So how is it his?
Because it was a very convenient excuse to,
okay.
Yeah. This whole corruption, like, however, the car wash investigation may have started off, you know, as a clean enterprise, but now the whole thing seems to be sprawling.
Is it sprawling, like, to other politicians?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's gotten, like, almost every single member of their federal legislature is involved in one way or another. Like, they got a few top executives in state-owned companies to flip, and they just churned out their ledger books with all the names.
Oh, okay. They somehow got the person who was trying to give this house to Lula to say that, at least.
And it also goes to show that the problem with sources, especially in law enforcement and intelligence, because a lot of these executives probably are saying a lot of this stuff to save their own skin, or, you know, make sure the right politicians get indicted.
So does Lula have any, you know, successors, any underlings?
Proteges? Yeah, that was Rosa de Moro. She was the previous president, and she, again, was kicked out of office.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because he basically handed the presidency to her, but she was not as adept, apparently, at the political dealings as he was.
So, but there must be still some element of the party, or is the party pretty much in tatters?
It's in tatters and chaos because of all of these allegations. Like, they might end up with a Trump candidate, like one of their rabid right-wing guys out of Rio de Janeiro, who was, 4 or 5 months ago, said something along the lines of, like, yeah, the military dictatorship was great. We need to bring that back. There was so much more order than there is now, or something along those lines.
From the Workers' Party?
No, he was from he's a rabid evangelical conservative.
Have fun with that, Brazil.
Like, way worse than Trump and his beliefs, obviously, because the military dictatorship killed and tortured thousands of people.
Mm-hmm. All right. Speaking of government management or mismanagement, we will be back in a second with a little talk about deficits and why they matter.
What I want you to understand is the national debt is not the only cause of that. It is because America has not invested in its people. It is because we have not grown. It is because we've had 12 years of trickle-down economics. We've gone from first to 12th in the world in wages. We've had 4 years where we produced no private sector jobs. Most people are working harder for less money than they were making 10 years ago. It is because we are in the grip of a failed economic theory. And this decision you're about to make better be about what kind of economic theory you want.
So when we say deficit, we're talking about the difference between the spending of a government and the...
how much they take in, like their revenue.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so why does that... I mean, I think people could relate it analogously to themselves. I mean, you know, you can only get so many lines of credit and loans from the bank and... But how is that similar or different than a personal deficit, so to speak?
Well, thankfully, the U.S. government has, 330 million citizens that are notionally required to pay taxes, which offers, shall we say, a guaranteed income stream.
Okay.
And so the Federal Reserve, which is, I guess to put it most generally in this context, is an organization of bankers. It's not a government institution. It gives money to the government, but I'll get to that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, the bank. So, of course, it's willing to provide unlimited credit to the federal government, which is why you hear a lot of the time people on the left and the right say deficits don't matter because it's so easy for us to get this money, and that's, shall we say, a mistaken notion, at least to my mind.
I could compare that to a personal situation where, well, yeah, but I can just get more.
There's only a finite amount of resources in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it can only go on so long, right, I would think?
Yes, for various reasons. But probably not the ones that you would expect.
So the
way the government creates money, right? Like, because right now the U.S. debt clock, as I'm saying this, says that our U.S. national debt has gone to $20.6 trillion. Well, you know, you put a couple of wars on the credit card and some bank bailouts, it just sprawls.
Mm-hmm. Okay, big tax cuts for the rich and corporations, yeah.
All right, so when the government borrows money, it creates bonds. Like, it has to get bonds, which are created by the Federal Reserve and sold to a select group of banks.
Okay.
They're like the solid gold standard in financial instruments. U.S. government bonds have never been defaulted on in living memory.
Okay.
And so these banks are able to take these bonds, which they're basically given at almost cost, which, you know, that money is then given to the government to fund its operations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which a lot of the time in this day and age amounts to rolling over the debt. So these companies are able to take these bonds and then sell them to large pension organizations like CalPERS, other large banks or banks that don't have their privileged access to the discount window, which is what they call it, and then other subsidiary. Like, almost individual investors will almost never have these kind of assets directly in, you know, their... inventory, so to speak, or in their portfolio.
Okay.
And if they do, they are probably insanely wealthy. Like, the 1% of the 1% of people could buy a U.S. government bond outright for its full face value.
Why is it... why can only certain institutions or people buy them?
Because that's the way the Federal Reserve does it. And, yeah. So it creates... not only, as I said, a privileged position for these 20 banks, which subsequently to the 2008 financial crisis have only worked to increase their market share. So Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, they all before the financial crisis that most they might have had 10% of the market, and now I think Wells Fargo's market share is up to 30%, if memory serves.
Okay.
Which makes them, you know, if too big to fail was a problem, why are we making them bigger? But that's another problem. All right, so the federal government is taking this money and borrowing it from incredibly rich people who have no financial incentive to spend the money that they make off of these bond transactions. They're purely left in their portfolios to just hold their value. Like, on paper, they can be like, this bond is worth this much and is going to cash out at a coupon rate of this percent, so that is how much money I can guarantee that I will have at this date.
Oh, okay.
Which, in some ways, is better than cash on hand, because cash could be influenced by inflation, and these, well, some of them are marked to inflation, but most aren't. But it usually doesn't matter, because especially since 2008, we've had, like, what, 1% interest rates? So
how could they not be marked to inflation, though? I mean,
well, they just pay a certain amount on a certain amount of dollars, and that amount that they pay doesn't increase. So say, for instance, you have a $100,000 bond that pays out, like, say, 1% after 10 years. That'll be, you know, $101,000 in 10 years. But if, say, inflation goes up and that by, well, we'll be generous and say 8% in those 10 years, then that value of the bond has actually decreased.
Okay.
So why does this matter?
Yeah.
As I was saying, these people have no incentive to put the money back into the economy, which this kind of goes into why the bank bailouts weren't the most efficient way of deploying that capital in the wake of the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they had bailed out the individual homeowners, it would have, the financial crisis probably would have been resolved a lot sooner, and the banks would have just gotten the money anyway.
Yeah.
But instead they just gave it directly to the banks, and the homeowners were left to figure out their own personal balance sheets, resulting in a lot of home losses and such, in the terrible misery that was inflicted upon the country and the wider world in general.
Yeah, there's a weird notion where institutions are allowed to fail, and their failure might hurt average people. And so in this country, to prevent the hurt of average people, we have to save the institution instead of just saving the people. It's like there's this notion that you can't just give money to people. You can't just give money to citizens, because that would mean it doesn't, you know, it's like you treat them like children. Like, well, but then right. They won't learn a lesson.
But I didn't earn it.
Yeah, but an institution doesn't have to learn a lesson.
It's, or earn it.
Yeah, it's just a weird, I don't know. But anyway.
It's a weird dichotomy.
So,
okay, so why does this matter? Like, now I think the federal government is spending almost half of its budget just trying to roll over this debt.
No. Okay.
But more importantly, this matters to the velocity of money, which is a kind of an abstract economic term, which tries to measure how quickly a dollar goes around the economy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If that
yeah.
makes any yeah, sense.
No, I've heard of this concept before.
Right, and the velocity of money is not helped by having a handful of people literally sit on all of the money in the form of government bonds like this.
Yeah, so I think a way to look at this velocity idea is, If you had a lot of velocity, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you had a high velocity where money is transferring hands into this vibrant economy, something like trickle-down economics might actually kind of work.
Yes, that is actually kind of the case, because
But if you don't have it moving around, then there's Like, it's well...
Nothing is trickling down.
Even them calling it trickle-down economics, by the way, is sort of, like, tells me it doesn't work. Because it's like you're acknowledging, at best, it's a trickle. Which has a connotation of not much volume.
Right, the waiters can lick the drips of wine that roll off the glasses from when we overfill them.
Yeah,
they can live off that, right?
They don't call it waterfall economics or anything, where it's like, wow, all of this money coming down to us.
A strangely visceral image, too, depending on how you take it.
So it's kind of a... It's this velocity... Now, is there a way that they measure it? Like, is it a quantitative...
You can look at the St. Louis Federal Reserve. But right now, it is at its lowest point that it has ever been measured, according to this chart that I'm looking at.
That's bad, right?
Yeah, it's lower than the heyday of the 90s, which is when it was best. And it's lower than the highlight during the, in the early 80s between the... various crises that between the the gas inflation and the SNL crisis that was another high point, and then it goes up to 2.2 between 1995 and 2000, which is when it was the fastest, and then slightly after 2005 it was up to just over 2, and then it dropped more precipitously in our last financial crisis than it did in any previous, but it hasn't gone up since. There was a brief blip after 2010, and now we've just seen continued downward movement, which is reflected in our Gini coefficient, in, shall we say, 82% of all wealth generated last year went to the top 1%, or some insane number like that?
Yeah. Yeah, and I just heard a stat this morning that... the administration pushes how great the stock market is, but it's like something like half of people don't own stock, which you can flip that, glass half full. Well, half of people do own stock, but it's something like, it was something like 80% of the stock market is owned by 10 people, or 10% of the, something maybe even less than that, 1%.
Yeah, and a lot of it is distributed into retirement funds, too. So most people, even if they do own stock, never own it directly.
Yes. That's what I would have, yeah. Okay, so the velocity of money, and you have this deficit, so where were we going from there?
I was just trying to draw a line from that to inequality.
Oh, okay,
Get the accumulation of assets. This causes an accumulation of assets, which... further reduces the velocity of money and further reduces the efficiency of our economy.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's this velocity and the money, or in this case the bonds, staying in a few hands, points to how economy isn't just size. It's not just GDP. It's not just what the Dow's at right now. It's
right. You can't measure how well your car is doing based on how much fuel you have in the tank.
Yeah.
That doesn't...
yes, yeah.
I mean, it may help the car run, but it doesn't... And it in some way churns over the engine, but...
Yeah, does your 10 gallons get you, 200 miles, or does it get you 20 miles? There's a big difference there.
There's an easy metaphor here to make, too, because, that spark of inspiration, which encourages economic development, that gets the engine running... is not helped by fewer people having resources to education and those kind of things. Like, people adapt to challenge, and, that one kid in Mali who made a wind farm or a windmill based off of a library book is a great example of that, but usually it doesn't have to be so dramatic and so stark. Like, you have to do this or you will die. I mean, maybe that does cause some change, but it's usually... not very good.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing Americans took away from the 20th century is that we're trying to avoid situations like that. We feel, or we should be feeling, that we can innovate and change and progress without the threat of starvation and death. We shouldn't have to do that.
Right. It's better for everybody, right?
Yeah. I mean, especially when, again, it's not like there's a total lack of resources or capital in the country.
We could fund, like, healthcare and college for everybody with the amount of money that we have, but, yeah. Anyways.
Okay, so how does... Okay, so, I mean, so there's the problem. Inequality. We have this deficit, which then the way it's it functions is that it's exacerbating inequality. So...
We stop fighting wars would be a good start, but that's it.
Okay.
Maybe a broader picture.
Like,
if stop... You know, just running off of deficits. It's no coincidence that during Bill Clinton's, well, balanced budget, when mm-hmm. he balanced budget by increasing tax revenues so high that this velocity of money went up to, like, what, 2.2, as I said, in the late 90s?
And
is remembered as a time of prosperity?
Yeah, so that's that, and that would be the last time that we had a balanced budget, right?
Yeah, and it was partly brought about by some expansions of the social safety net. Like, I know when I was a kid, because we were so desperately poor, I was able to get a job through JETPA over the summer. Which, you know, gives poor people money, which encourages them to spend, which further increases tax revenues and further increases the velocity of money, and the government is able to spend that again.
Yes. Hmm. So what other kind of ways can we... So, broader... So, but here's what you're going to see. So, if you brought this up right now, if we were, instead of sitting here on our lovely, open-minded podcast, and we were on a CNN or fucking whatever, MSNBC panel, and there was mm-hmm. some Paul Ryan staff member next to us, they would say, well, we can't afford to do the safety nets because of the deficit, is what they would say.
And I would say that's a self-defeating argument, obviously. You're creating these deficits and,
go ahead.
You don't make people wealthier by starving them and forcing them to work harder for, like, the few scraps that trickle down the side of your fucking leg.
The inherent nature of the velocity of the money and... The movement and the efficiency of the economy is kind of how you defeat this idea of just there being a fine, you know, here's how much money there is, we have this much of a deficit, we can't afford to spend, because then they're not going to make any money either,
well,
as the government.
Right.
Or at least not as
much. Well, the problem is that they don't spend it well. Like, if they, for instance, as I said before, if they had given out money to all the homeowners in 2008, the homeowners would have given that money back to the banks, and those transactions would have been taxed, and that money would have just immediately started coming back, instead of having to claw it back in the form of very, very low interest rate loans that
mm-hmm.
the business community was like, hey, we made the government this much money, and it's like, did you really?
Yeah.
Did you really? I mean, what about the economic costs of the fact that we spent that money and weren't able to, I don't know, spend that money on a national infrastructure program, or... expanding healthcare options, you know, things that could genuinely improve the efficiency of our economy. I try to argue it from a business angle.
Yeah.
Just so the fact that the people who would argue in that, you know, conservative way don't have as much of a leg to stand on.
Oh, exactly. And I think this is, has to be the messaging going forward.
Exactly. Attack them on their talking points, in their philosophy.
Especially, you know, if we are going through this time where we have you just point out the numbers yourselves, this is the lowest ever recorded for the velocity of money, where we have this, you know, giant stock market number, numbers we've never seen before. We have low unemployment, and yet we still have... great inequality.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and another easy talking point off of that same philosophy is when people tell you that you can't question the military, tell them that your taxpayer funds the military and that you were just doing oversight and due diligence.
You can't. What was that? You can't question the military.
This one conservative guy was, we were at, a bar in Janesville one night this past summer, and we were having, you know, the usual political conversation, and this guy, like, comes up to us and starts trying to argue with me using conservative talking points. And he was like, oh, this is so informed, because he likes rhetorical argument, and he was like, this is so useful, I never heard of that talking point. Or, you know, he was like, apparently his friends must have been conservative, because the point that he had apparently hammered into him was that you can't question the military. And that was a point that I was, you know, arguing against when he walked up. And I was like, yeah, we pay for the military's budget. Don't let anyone ever tell you that we can't question the military or anything that they do.
That's why you have civilian leadership of the military.
Right.
We addressed that issue like 220 years ago or so.
Kind of part of the reason we had that whole revolution.
Yeah, like, you can't question the military. Why don't we just let them stay in our bedrooms, too? Fucking quarter in our houses. Can't question the military. What is that bullshit? What? Like, because you wear a badge or a uniform, there's, like, this air of
superiority.
Yeah, I mean, you can still love and support. I mean, it's just like a family member. You can love and support a family member, but that doesn't mean you aren't allowed to criticize ever.
I mean, the fact that they're public servants should make them more open to criticism. And yes, I understand they do a difficult job, but if they're not doing it well, then we all need to help them do it better.
And in the era of Trump, I have heard a lot of veterans, I mean, because, you know, when they're serving and they have a commander-in-chief like this, you know, it's touchy. But I've heard a lot of veterans in articles and TV and...
And this podcast.
And this podcast, you know, say, like, that people should speak up. You know, it's our job to, or if they're a veteran, was their job, to listen. You know, like, they don't want anyone to not speak their mind. That's not what they're about.
That's not what America is about, which is, you know, what we're fighting for or fought for.
Yeah, it doesn't say anywhere in the Constitution. It's not like there's a bonus amendment at the end that says, oh, yeah, and you're not allowed to say anything about the military.
Yeah, that was the lost 11th Amendment.
Yes. Okay. Did you want to say...
But anyways, getting back to economics.
Yeah, go ahead.
So... But, yeah, that defense spending, the fact that we fought two wars and are continuing to put bases in over 140 countries all over the world is why we're running into these problems in this vast inequality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because a lot of those defense contractors just hoover up the money, but, yeah, anyways.
So again, it is that we're spending a lot of money on it, but it's again how the money's being. It's like the group, the people it's going to,
and how it's being raised. Yeah,
yeah.
They get it both coming and going.
Yeah.
Which is why it's easy to make money if you have money, because you can buy those bonds and like those high quality financial instruments with huge price tags.
Are there laws against other people buying them, or they just aren't offered?
Only certain companies are allowed under the Federal Reserve Act to have access to that window, yeah.
It's such a wild thing. And you can't buy... Can you buy bonds from a bank?
Yes, you can buy bonds from... Usually from banks who have bought them from other banks who have bought them from other banks, so you can't get them nearly the same rate.
Okay, so yeah, you're paying more for the same amount.
Right, because the price goes up every pair of hands goes through. Yeah,
that makes sense.
And that's just one of the, you know, that's why what I see as one of the fundamental issues with our economy, as I have been trying to point out.
Well, let's, if you have any last thoughts on this, and then we'll...
I would say it's not a good time to invest in the stock market, so I guess... We're not at the point of keeping your money under a mattress, but...
Why do you say that? That's not a good time to invest.
Because of these underlying, shall we say, economic insecurities. like the velocity of money issue that I just pointed out doesn't preclude, doesn't, wouldn't make me want to invest in the American economy right now. The fact that they're not able to legislate properly, like Bill Clinton was able to get the economy working in part because, you know, I may not have agreed exactly with, in hindsight, I might not agree with his policies, but he was able to get things moving and get the balanced budget and work with Congress to, you know, help improve people's lives, distribute money to science and research, improve education, and we're going to see absolutely none of that out of this administration. I mean, Paul Ryan may get some kind of entitlement look this year, but I would guarantee that the Democrats are almost not going to compromise. Well, or at least there's going to be very little appetite for compromise.
It seems like anything that they would pass would only amplify these issues.
Yes.
Problems.
Like, the tax cut was, you know, almost... it couldn't have been made any better if they had the idea of increasing wealth inequality in mind when they wrote it.
Yeah. It's almost as if they're trying to do that.
But it passed so quickly. Anyways, yeah. That's my final thoughts
okay.
for that.
Yeah, no, I like that. I think that's good. And maybe if they next time, if there is like another big legislative push for something in the coming year, we should kind of revisit this conversation and sort of look at it through this lens.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll be back with a hip-hop test drive. With the dope rhyme that I kick. Evidence is at the dope. All right, let's hop in the car, turn up the bass, smoke a blunt. We're going to do a hip-hop test drive right now. We have a new album from... Is it brand new or did it just come out? It's 2018, so...
Yeah.
It's new. From Evidence, from the legendary underground group Dilated Peoples. It's called Weather or Not. It's, I guess, the third in his Weatherman trilogy. If you don't know Evidence, he's, as I said, from Dilated Peoples, which never really had mainstream success, but in terms of underground is a...
one of the big bands.
Yeah.
Or one of the big groups.
He is a 41-year-old Southern California native from L.A. What did you think?
I liked it. The one thing I'll say about this, and it seems to be kind of a going trend in hip-hop, is that, like, just with No Dope on Sundays, they released, like, one great track and named the whole album after it.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily agree with that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. How does it... and I'll say that I liked it as well. Don't know if I loved it, if I was to give it, like, a score. Other things later. I wanted to talk, though, about your... not yours, but ODB's abstract commercial hardcore scale. How does this factor into that?
Well, it's certainly abstract with his... Mm-hmm. Well, I say his content is abstract. Not the album itself, necessarily, but...
Yeah, it's not like a weird, but it has...
it's not like a weird album, but it's certainly abstract.
Yeah,
it has abstract ideas.
I was thinking about this, because I was thinking, okay, how would I place it into that? Abstract seems the best, but I think maybe abstract isn't the best word for what I think ODB was going for. I mean, I'm sure it fits into what he was doing, but to me, I don't know what the better word is. I'd have to think about it, but it's more like, is it about, like, is it intellectual, commercial, or hardcore? Maybe would be a better word. Is it about ideas and...
Well, it's kind of like an interesting... That's why they're mutually exclusive. Like, you have abstract, which is about hardcore, well, which is all about ideas. Hardcore, which is all about life. And commercial, which is all about money.
Yeah. And so, anyway, I think this is definitely abstract. Maybe with a twinge of hardcore at times. Nothing much, though.
The hardcore nature of underground rap, but... He's not a gangster rapper.
Yeah, I mean, there was, like, I don't know, there was a song
about, what is it, powder cocaine.
Yeah, the one with the slug disappearance.
Yeah, yeah. I actually really like that. It would probably be one of my top couple off the album. I just, that the hook in that song is really catchy.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a twinge of commercial in here, though.
How do you see that? Little. How do you see that?
Well, it's not exactly going for the mainstream commercial market, but the guy, you can't say underground so many times and not be aiming for, like, you know, the main underground market.
Yeah, so it's
really self-aware in the fact that it is selling to a certain group of people.
Yes.
And that is inherently commercial.
That's interesting. Because on one side of underground, it's inherently not commercial in that it's not mainstream. But you still kind of, you know, so much of music, even somewhat mainstream stuff, is niche marketing nowadays. You know, there's no Beatles anymore.
No.
And so... like, even, I bet if I looked at, like, some of the top couple bands of the past few years, a lot of people would not know anything by them. Like, yeah, I barely know shit from Bruno Mars, and he's, like...
I was gonna say, I don't know who he is, really.
I know a little bit. I know he did a Super Bowl show, and I think there's a couple songs I'm sure I've heard, you know.
Like, the girls play.
When I'm in a mall or something like that. But I certainly, it's not like... You know, there's no Michael Jacksons anymore. There's no Led Zeppelins and Beatles. And I don't mean in terms of quality. I mean in terms of popularity. So anyway, but yeah, there's an aspect of underground where you're marketing to an idea. It's still marketing, which means it's still commercial.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
and he's definitely living in that. He has a self-aware presence there.
Yeah, so it's, I don't know, definitely at least one or two on the commercial part of the ODB scale.
Yeah, and he's using The Alchemist and DJ Premier do production on the album. Those are big, popular DJs, at least within the underground community. So, yeah, I think you're right on it. Has it's not a 5 out of 5 in commercial, but yeah, it's got a couple points there. What were some of the highlight tracks for you?
I really liked Whether or Not. It was a really good album, or a good song. I mean, if you're going to name the album after that, they picked the best song for that. I really liked the last song. The name of it is By My Side 2, talking about his terrible experience with cancer. I hope his significant other is doing great and his baby boy's all right.
Yeah. I liked, as I said earlier, Powder Cocaine.
Sell Me This Pen, I think, was the other highlight track. With Alchemist.
Okay, yep. I liked 10,000 Hours, actually. Which I think was the one produced by DJ Premier. It has, like, this really sick bass, kind of underlying bass to it. And the other reason I like that song is just that message of... because he kind of talks about his evolution as a rapper. And they say... The 10,000 hour thing, I believe, is in reference to you do anything for 10,000 hours, you're going to be good at it.
Practice makes perfect, yeah, after all.
Yeah, you practice for 10,000 hours at painting, you'll be good. Fishing, you know, golf, whatever.
Storytelling.
Unless you cheat at golf, like Trump. yeah. And probably DJing, too.
How many hours do you think Premier has put in? Sorry, that's a...
Well, I mean, you know, the thing, too, is, like, how many hours did he put in until he was good? But then once you're good at it, you know, you can still keep going at it, and so then you're... You're legendary. Man, at some point.
He was good with the first Gangstar album back in, like, 87.
Yeah, I mean, how much...
And even before... Yeah.
I haven't done the math on what 10,000 hours is, but, I mean, if you've been putting in the time in your room at home and, you know, doing it long enough, you know, before you hook up with someone... I've heard that a lot about stand-up, too, by the way.
I mean, there's the occasional stand-up person that hits it young that, you know, there's no way they could have put in. I mean, 10,000 hours is obviously an arbitrary number, but a long time is the idea. A lot of times, supposedly in the stand-up community, like, you're not expected to be good for years. And, you know, since you only do 5 minutes at a pop right away, it takes a while. Which actually, this kind of gets me to what I was going to bring up a little bit. This idea of putting in time. So, I was watching a Hip Hop DX video with MERS. It's a cool YouTube series. Check it out. He does these breakdowns, they're called. A lot of times it's like, is so-and-so the greatest of all time? And I can't remember the guy's name, but the person who hosted before him used to do, like, greatest of all time videos all the fucking time. And they just are kind of, like, looking at the resume. The guy isn't saying, I think this person is the greatest of all time. It's more like a question. Like, how would we define this, and does this person fit a definition? So there was one that MERS did recently, which is the Beastie Boys the greatest group of all time? And the first thing he says in to introduce the video is he's excluding Wu-Tang Clan, which he considers a crew, because they aren't like all on every song.
No, they do so many. It's like a collaborative, like collective, like than a
co-op
group.
Almost. Yeah. So he was excluding Wu-Tang, which
You pay your dues into the Wu-Tang members clan, and then you get your obligatory Method Man or RZA track on every album.
Yeah, yeah. We don't need to get into the whether or not
Wu-Tang,
the Beastie Boys are. But he brought up this idea in it, which I thought was really interesting, and I think you could apply to a lot of acts in hip-hop. And that is, so he talks throughout the video about how Beastie Boys always had 1 foot in rock and 1 foot in rap. And it wasn't just a style thing, like they did kind of rock-twinge songs. It was almost like how to get a following. And it's really easy to say, well, they were white, rock kids are white. And he brought up this idea that part of the reason they were able to stay successful for years, stay relevant, stay fresh, and have this long career is because rock people celebrate their legends and their stars, and they oftentimes continue supporting them. Now, of course, in pop music, there's always going to be what's new, what's fresh. But he says the hip-hop community has a crazy fascination with what's new and what's fresh. And he attributes it to the urban side of the hip-hop base. You know, people in cities are more on the cutting edge, whereas rock is a little bit more suburban or even rural at times. And they aren't as much into that. And he says, like, oh, of course you can point out exceptions, but that's just what they are. They're exceptions. You know, like LL Cool J or Jay-Z. But he points out how those people would have to do, as they got into their career, collaborations with new and fresh rappers to stay relevant. And that would help launch
the hottest rappers.
Yeah, to help. Or they'd change their style a bit. I mean, LL Cool J definitely changed his style between the 80s and the 90s. I don't know that, say, Jay-Z has changed his style as much, but he's always made sure to do collabs with Eminem, Kanye.
Nas.
And that's kept him relevant and, you know, hip to the kids. And anyway, it got me thinking about something else I've noticed with hip-hop, which is kind of similar, which is it possible to break out of the underground? Because I was listening to this album, it's like, yeah, as you said, he talks about it, him being underground. He's obviously marketing that. You never hear about someone who's underground for multiple albums. And it's not just, you know, because there is sort of like a community to the underground. And it seems like impossible to break out of that. And is that just because once you are labeled underground, you can no longer be a new, fresh thing to the mainstream, and you're just stuck there. You can't break out, and so you have to then market to it because there's nothing else to market to.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I guess, but...
I could only think of one example, and that was the Black Eyed Peas, and that's just because they brought on a singer and completely changed their style.
Yeah, that was... Yeah. I can't think of anybody else. I mean, Whitey Ford had, like, one breakout single, but that was, like, completely against his typical style.
You mean Everlast?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was his first solo effort, though, I believe.
Is Nas underground?
Well, I don't know. Nas hit...
mainstream success.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's pretty early on.
Headlines Summerfest every year now.
If anything, I would say Nas is more of like a fading star rather than underground. Like, he has more name recognition than Evidence. To bring it back.
How about Blackalicious? Are the Gift of Gab and DJ XL underground?
I would say yes.
Okay. But they're pretty widely known.
Kind of. Yeah, but they're not going to be played on... They're not, you know...
Played on commercial radio,
yeah. Yeah, he's not going to be, you know, featured in a Super Bowl halftime show or anything. I mean, he's... You can be somewhat... I mean, especially with... like, here's an example of someone where I think... They're a little bit in both worlds, but again, they didn't pay their dues underground and then break out. But like Tyler, the Creator, by nature of what he's doing, he's not getting like a ton of radio play, and
but he's still on a mainstream record label now.
Yeah, exactly, and he's got a big presence. But that was almost right away. That was after like a year or two of doing it. They didn't have four underground albums, and then they had one that got really big. You know, if anything, you just kind of have these simmering underground people that... Or, sorry, not underground. Like, these simmering mainstream artists that aren't, like, the biggest, but you'd call them still, like, the low level of mainstream, and then they'll have a big album that blows up.
Or that they try to blow up.
Yeah, so I'd say, like, Outkast back in the day... They, like, Miss Jackson became this mega hit. And before that, I wouldn't have called them underground.
Oh, yeah, there's your example of somebody who was underground and went mainstream. Absolutely, Outkast. They were doing, like, bum shows all over Georgia before they ever got a main hit. Yeah, before they even did a studio album. They were huge down south.
Yeah, I guess. Well, anyway, back to Evidence. It just got me thinking, because I'm like, okay, this is... I don't think it's, like, the greatest album, but I do think it's a really good album. Every song's good. It's got... Maybe my one problem with him just overall is that... I think he's... His... Like, I remember in the Cupcake review, he said how she has, like, a couple different styles. I would say Evidence has one style that he does
on every song. Yeah, he only has, like, one cadence that he uses for every song.
Yeah, so... But whatever.
But
I mean, I think
he varies it up with rhyme schemes.
Yes, he does. He's a very, very good rhymer, and he has a lot of ideas. So I don't care that much about the same style throughout. But I think it's a really good album. And I was like, if this album was made by a mainstream artist, everyone would be like, this is a really good album, and he'd sell a ton.
This is so revolutionary.
But because he's underground, it can't break out of that. You know, thinking about the underground to mainstream, I have one more nomination, but it's, again, they made a significant change. And that's, I think Killer Mike was a little bit mainstream, but LP was not a mainstream rapper.
Oh, absolutely not. Before he was on the God of Underground.
Yes, exactly. And he's broken out, but he hooked up with a mainstream guy, and they started a whole new project together, which, that project started off as probably underground, but... Yeah,
they can't be that successful and still be underground. And...
Yeah, I mean, they've just, over the three albums, they just built more and more. They do media appearances. I mean, they've kind of broken out of that. I think they're probably one of the big... I mean, they appear on, like, Colbert and shit all the time.
Yeah. Also great to follow on Twitter, by the way, those two.
Yeah, I think I follow one of them. I'm not sure. Probably Killer Mike. Even though he tweets in a language I don't really understand, I'll be honest. There's a lot of hashtags going on, and I get confused. It's part of the reason I stick to mostly political tweeting. It's because it's usually just by journalists who are all about, like, really clear sentence structures and shit. And I'm like, okay, grammar. I know what they're talking about. I'm a tight-laced. Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, I mean, I think I'd recommend this album.
Absolutely.
It reminds me of, which one? It reminds me a little bit of the Talib Kweli album. It's a different style to it, but it's just a really solid album from a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you're looking for something to throw on, I think I like the production value better than that one, personally. I think this one has a little bit catchier of hooks to it, and it's got that style of drum beat and hip-hop that I love. It reminds me of like early 2000s hip-hop music. So...
Yeah, another great contribution from, as you said, a veteran.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I would highly recommend it. The only complaint that I have is, like, not even about him or any of the production value, but so I don't even think it's worth saying.
I'll say it anyway.
Oh, Slug. I think Slug's verse is the weakest contribution really? To that entire album.
Do you just not like...
Like, it's not... I usually like Slug. I just think it's weak for him, even.
I don't know. I was going to say I kind of liked it, but it wasn't... I just think he has a... He just has, like, a great voice. Like, his mm-hmm. voice sounds fucking dope no matter what he's saying on a hip-hop track. It's like, if you could just computer model his voice and then just, like, write out words for him, like, that would be super fun. Just, like, have a computer program where you, like, you can make it rap like Slug. I honestly think he has one of my favorite hip-hop voice. Just voices. Again, not ideas, style, skill... Just his mm-hmm. voice sounds great in music. I don't know if it's the way he's mixed or that's... I've never seen him live.
Well, and it's got to be partly the Midwestern accent, too.
Yeah. And it has just, like, a little bit of a... It's just kind of, like, full and rich. No, like, if he doesn't... He should do radio or something. I don't know what... He does music full-time, but he could just host a podcast or something. He would sound great. Yeah, okay, I mean, that's a fair complaint. I mean, yeah, again, that. I mean, hey, no, I would say that, I mean, hey, that's still evidence putting it on his album. It's not like he's forced to do this, so, I mean, it's part of the album. It is
getting produced on the Rhymesayers label, so mm-hmm. I think is Slug the CEO? I think he is.
Probably a founding member.
It's just like the Wu-Tang, you get your franchise.
Yeah.
Contribution on every album.
Yeah, I mean, you get RZA on a track.
And Method, yeah. Or Method Man, depending on who's available.
All right. Well, that's been a hip-hop test drive of Evidence's new album, Whether or... Which is a pun. You'll see it typed out. Whether or Not, when he has a song that talks about how he loves weather, too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll be back with some closing thoughts. Boom, boom, boom. All right, well, it's been a nice episode of Tell Me What to Think. In the closing thoughts here, I wanted to do a couple things. First, I want to have a short little talk about Syria, which we did in a deep dive last week. And I think it was like...
Unlike most of our deep dives, we came to no point.
Yeah, well, and like most of our deep dives, there was relevant news that happened around or shortly after us doing it, which was Tillerson, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, gave a speech. I think it was just to like some private foreign policy group or at a university or something. But he laid out important things, and he laid out... U.S. policy in Syria, which kind of along what you were saying, but in conflict with what I was saying, which is that we will probably be there a long time.
Yeah, they want to be there as long as they can be.
And they laid out, which is in conflict with what Trump campaigned on, by the way.
Take all of his promises at their opposite value at this point.
Yeah, I know. Like, I was, like, trying to give him credit for at least that one, because that one made sense to me. Right. But...
Well, you know, you can't drain the swamp and then import foreign new South American alligators.
I'm telling you, they just drained the swamp. so as to isolate the swamp creatures and then put them in positions of power. That is the drain the swamp's just the first step towards enabling swamp creatures. They just don't tell you the rest of that.
Well, what about the ecology? They need the water, man.
Oh, they'll pump back in, like, radioactive sludge, which will give them all mutant swamp creature powers.
And, but anyways, but
which will lead to entitlement reform or some shit. Anyway, so we don't need to spend a bunch of time on it, but Tillerson laid out, I think it was five conditions that would have to be met for the U.S. to end its presence in Syria. And the long and short of it is that all of these conditions are, like, about... well, there has to be, like, no terrorists, and there has to be no fighting, and there has to be peace, and there has to be no Assad. And it's like, none of these things are going to... Even if four of them happen, now then, then you have a fifth. And it's all five of these are not going to happen, at least not anytime soon. It seems like it's turning into a lot like Iraq. And... maybe the goal here is to prevent it turning into what Iraq turned into. But I don't know if we have enough presence there to do that. Right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Well, we would be depending on the Syrian military for a lot of it.
Which we apparently also have a condition of them not having their president, dictator man, in power. So it's like, how are we going to work well with them?
It's a pretty self-defeating strategy that's designed to keep us in Syria for as long as we possibly can be.
The other thing I wanted to quick go over with Syria was, and maybe we can tie this into now that we know the U.S. is going to be there a long time, what are some of the other countries in the area? We didn't really get into the kind of regional geopolitics of it, except Turkey.
Right. Well, and by an interesting aside, they also announced in a big development that they were going to clear their entire northern border, which includes a nice little town called Manbij, which is where a lot of U.S. forces are currently stationed. Oh, and we're going to stop supporting the YPG with weapons, too.
We are.
Yeah. The United States is no longer going to be supporting the Kurds that helped kick out ISIS, Daesh.
And we're leaving from any presence in the north of Syria? Is that because Turkey's coming in?
I haven't seen anything about us withdrawing, but we're not going to be supporting the YPG, the militia that we were supporting that the Turks insist is a terrorist group.
Mm-hmm. So what does... Does the U.S. presence there, does the war, how it's been going, how does Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, is there anything kind of that wouldn't be obvious or clear to a listener about how those countries have or will react?
Nothing immediately springs to mind. Like, the one thing that I could think of is that the Iranians might not demobilize the militias that mm-hmm. they've raised, which would put more of an economic strain on their economy.
Which is kind of what they've been having protests about.
Right.
Does Saudi Arabia support militias or anything like that there?
The Saudis supported individual groups, but they were kind of supported them on an individual basis. Okay. Like, you'd get the rich people who were donating money to Islamists, and the Saudi intelligence had their own horses, but I think they've pretty much backed off from supporting, like, the Free Syrian Army and Ansar al-Sham and all the other groups that they were supporting.
Okay, and I saw, I think, if I remember the news correctly, within the past week or so, Vice President Mike Pence met with the King of Jordan, I believe.
Yeah, he had his victory lap tour around the Middle East. He met with President Sisi in Egypt, He met with Netanyahu and the King of Jordan, but the Palestinian president and Palestinian Authority wanted nothing to do with his visit, and Abbas was in Europe for the time.
When you call it a victory tour, what are they? What are we? What is he victorious about?
The embassy in Jerusalem.
Oh yeah, so he's going around to a bunch of Muslim, predominantly Muslim countries, celebrating. Seems weird.
Yeah, well, the Egyptians aren't necessarily against it. The Jordanians are just forced to eat. This is a decision.
Okay.
And the Israelis are all for it. And it's, in part, they're trying to organize the next phase of their, shall we say, international program, which is going to be a war with Iran. Hmm. As an interesting side note, the city that apparently the Trump administration is trying to hand to the Palestinians instead of East Jerusalem, Abu Dis.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at that on Google Maps as close as you can get, and the main thoroughfare to the city has a 20-foot wall just right on it. So you can't get to, you know, move between Jerusalem and what they hope to be the Palestinian capital. So I guess the capital of the open-air prison? Hooray!
the whole city has a wall, or what?
I think it's in one of the Area A's places, okay, where the Palestinian separation barrier, as they lovingly call it, actually encompasses like entire municipalities in the West Bank. So, you know, I think Abu Dis is one of those cities where it's like almost entirely surrounded by that 20-foot concrete barrier.
Huh.
And that's going to be their capital.
So that's a wall to keep Palestinians from going into Jewish territory?
Yeah, into Israel. Yeah, to keep into Palestinians Israel? Corralled, yeah.
Okay.
It was originally I conceived of in, like, the 80s when there was, like, a Israeli car being stolen, like, basically every other minute and being driven into the Palestinian West Bank. Yeah. And it's, you know, a great security barrier. Well, it helps... helps with their security and, shall we say, colonization. Oh, okay, I won't say that. They're not trying to colonize the West Bank. I'm not going to go the controversial.
Yeah. I mean, there are elements in Israel that would openly say they want to do that, though, right?
Right. They're called their Minister of Culture, Naftali Bennett, would definitely be all in favor of that. Or wait, is he Justice Minister now? Well, wherever he is, he's still in their government somewhere.
All right, the other thing in closing thoughts I want to do is I wanted to give a quick rundown of some big Wisconsin stuff. Or not always big, but some Wisconsin stuff lately. Most of it embarrassing, but, you know, let's just get it on the table. Let's be open and honest with ourselves as Wisconsinites.
I really don't know why she saw the need to carry a fake nose everywhere she went.
So our former... is she...
Yeah, former head of the DNR. She's
currently former, okay. Kathy Stepp, I think it's Kathy, was head of our Department of Natural Resources here, which the Wisconsin DNR is traditionally been a model environmental management agency, natural resource management agency for the country. And she's...
Until recently.
Yeah, she's been kind of the leader in destroying it, or at least neutering it. And anyway, it came out because she is about to be nominated...
Regional chair for the Environmental Protection Agency out of Chicago.
Of course.
And she's already assumed the position.
Because all the worst people...
percolating up.
Yep. And she... her daughter... It came out this week that her daughter once failed a driving test. And so Kathy Stepp put on a disguise and followed around one of the cars so as to train her daughter on the exact course.
Not exactly illegal, like not even necessary.
Yeah, just sort of embarrassing. I think embarrassing. It's just a little humiliating. That was like a government official for us.
Why would she carry around a fake nose, though? That's the part that I really don't get.
Yep, she, well, maybe she was having an affair. Or so, I mean, I don't want to spread rumors, but, you know, something like that. Like, why else would she need it?
Right.
She, you know, she puts on...
She was trying not to be hit or seen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think as much as politics in this state on the state level have been divisive and heated, I don't think anyone was about to like physically harm the DNR head.
No.
Other embarrassing thing. It was pretty big news, but I just want to give a Wisconsin take on it, which is our esteemed now second term senator from Wisconsin, Senator Ron Johnson, Republican, made the internet rounds in a video of him talking about. He was the first, as far as I know, Republican to be seen publicly talking about this conspiracy, which is now taken over their circles. And he was like, he looked like drunk and, you know,
disheveled,
crazy, yelling.
He goes in cycles.
Yeah. And yeah, he said there's a big conspiracy within the FBI to, I don't know what, to make Trump look bad. Like, who would need a conspiracy to do that?
Just put a camera at him.
But yeah, I mean, as much as, like, I think that's crazy as just a general national politics viewer, I was just like, oh, I took it so personally that this was a Wisconsin senator. So many times over the past, 7, 8 years, I say to myself, please don't be Ron Johnson, please don't be Ron Johnson, please don't be Ron Johnson.
And it is.
And it's Ron Johnson. Just in general, Paul Ryan. I don't know if we need to say more about that.
Yeah.
I mean, the Speaker of the House is from the district I was raised in, and he is just... He is like the... he's like the straight man for all of the Republican craziness that's going on.
That's why they need him to be in the front, because he's the most attractive.
Well,
the least crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a, you know, the media has spent almost 20 years now being like, ooh, he's the smart, knowledgeable, young, up-and-coming...
Policy wonk.
Yeah, Republican guy. No one knows the budget more than he does.
Anybody knows the budget better than Paul Ryan.
But, yeah, they've been pushing him as a... Even if you think about it, he ran with... Mitt Romney, you know, who didn't win, but Mitt Romney was kind of this, you know, respectable type Republican, and, you know, so right. Paul Ryan sort of associated with respectable Republicans, and he is just totally enabling the most crazy bullshit ever, and he's Speaker of the House.
Parts.
Like, he could, it wouldn't be an easy fight, but he could take part in squashing this. He really could.
Right.
And he is... I did
or he
see...
could just squash certain parts of the bills
yeah,
that come out.
Exactly. Or he could actually lead to more bipartisan things. He could let the House vote on... I mean, we talked about... I think we brought up on the podcast a week or two ago how one of our worries about DACA and the next couple weeks of negotiating that and the budget and the next CR is Paul Ryan. And how he's not going to let anything come to the table that doesn't have the majority of Republicans behind it. Even
right,
if a lot
Hastert
of Republicans.
Rule.
Yeah, the Hastert rule. And so he's really just... He doesn't... That's not a binding rule that he has to do. He could...
It's just that they're... Yeah, way they do it.
I mean, when you look... When you make Mitch McConnell look like less of a partisan hack, then you know you're bad.
Yeah.
And then the last thing is the embarrassment factor is debatable on this one. But there's a couple actually Iron Stash news. Randy Bryce, Paul Ryan's challenger. Nice segue there. He has to win the primary first, but I think he's going to win. But Iron Stash, a couple news this week. One is he, again, this will be coming out after the State of the Union, but he is... our congressman, Charles and I's congressman, Mark Pocan's guest for the State of the Union. So Iron Stash will be in the building watching his political opponent sitting right behind the president. Giving him the evil eye, I assume, or trying to make him laugh. Or because, you know, Paul Ryan's going to be glancing up there, I know it. He can't miss the stash.
Nah, it's visible from space.
And so all the Wisconsin Republicans have been saying what a breach of norms this is and how it's these assholes, and how this is, you know, inappropriate to the decorum of politics.
Whatever.
While they sit here and just let the president do whatever.
You guys can't do that and say decorum in the next breath.
I'll say this. You know who's one person who probably does not dislike that move? Trump. He probably hasn't even heard about it, but if, you know, if someone told him, like, oh, hey, you know, they're bringing Paul Ryan's political opponent here, he'd probably be like, ooh, that's a crafty move. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, respect.
He's not going to have.
No, he was the one that arrayed all of Bill Clinton's accusers in front of Hillary Clinton time, right?
At the town hall debate. Yep. So, I mean, this notion of, like, oh, that Republicans are allowed to break every fucking political norm there is, but Democrats aren't allowed to. Yeah, it's just ridiculous. And personally, I think of all of the political norms I've seen broken, this is a pretty tame one. I mean, if anything, you can look at it like educational. He's about to be the next congressman. He's about to unseat the Speaker of the House. I think he should be able to come to a State of the Union.
He's about to.
I don't know.
Well, okay. Well, can we talk? Well, let's talk a little bit about some bad news that came out about Iron Stash.
Was it this past week or the week before? The New York Times did an article about. What is it about?
Devumo.
About a company that you can pay to give you Twitter followers.
Yeah, it's one of the astroturfing companies.
And I don't know if it was that company. Was it that company? But it came out that Iron Stash early in his kind of blogging career, before he announced he was running for Congress, paid to have, it was like $10, but paid to get a couple thousand followers on Twitter, which is. You know, it's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's disqualifying, but it's embarrassing.
And another thing is that apparently he's some progressive media, like the Jimmy Dore Show and Ron Plakone were trying to reach out to him for an interview, and apparently they stopped returning, or Iron Stash's campaign stopped returning their calls, so to speak. So that's something.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, I'd like our candidates to be more open to, you know, media attention, even if it's not necessarily mainstream attention.
Yeah, I don't know if I would let my candidate, if I was running his campaign, I don't know that I would let him talk, go on that show. It's a touchy subject. Like media appearances. I think we talked on this show a little bit about access journalism from the journalist side of getting different people in. But you kind of have to look at it from the other side, too, then, from the person being interviewed. You know, what shows do you go on? What do you allow your candidates to go on? What kind of assurances? You know, there's sort of, just the other side of access journalism. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot... that has to happen behind the scenes. I mean, that's just the way these things go. Do you get a you know, you don't want to embarrass your guy, and you don't want guilt by association if you're running. Because the thing is about Iron Stash is that his campaign is trying to be very progressive with messaging, but very universal at the same time. It's all about, like, we are all together in this progressive movement, but he it's really trying hard to have a big tent. So, I don't know. It's touchy. I mean, I don't want to say for sure, like, it's a good move or a bad move by any means. But I don't know. What do you think about the followers thing? Do you think that's something maybe you should
apologize
about? I mean,
it's not going
to
hit him.
Or?
I think he said put out a statement saying that it was a mistake, and that's pretty much all it needed. He's not like one of the people that continuously block followers.
Correct. Yeah.
And there's tools out there that you can use to evaluate somebody's Twitter followers. Like, I think it was last year they were looking at, or during the campaign, they looked at Hillary's followers versus Trump's followers and found that they both are hugely astroturfed, but I think Trump's, like, even the majority of his users or followers are fake.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does that work then with the astroturfing?
Well, the more followers you have, the more visible your posts are to people.
Is that just because you have followers, or are there more likes to these?
Yeah, it's about engagements and followers. Twitter doesn't. It's like Mercedes-Benz. Their algorithm is all underneath a hood, but it seems to be the more followers you have, the more it will show people your posts, and the more likes and engagements you have, that even furthers that more. Okay. Like, but having more followers allows for more opportunities for engagement.
Okay. So, the idea is that it starts snowballing. Right. But obviously, if there's a case like Trump's, where the majority of them are this, then it seems like it reaches a ceiling.
You would think.
Like, because if it snowballed, if the whole idea is that it snowballs and it gains more real followers and more and more and more real followers, then you do just have to kind of plant that seed of astroturfing, like, say, Iron Stash did, and then it amplifies it with real people. But if you have more and more fake, and you're not getting, you know, it's not exponentially increasing the real people, then I don't know if that just means the user is flawed, which would make sense for Trump.
Or the algorithm is flawed, but ever since this came out in, what, David Dayen's article came out in early November, like, Twitter's stock has gone up, like, 13%. Jack has made over $100 million since, just off the increase in the value of his stock.
They just seem to be doing the bare minimum. It's like a kid getting in trouble. I
wonder if, like, you know, they're doing this as a way of, like, obfuscating their core issues that they have with users, fake and real. Like, it's easy to talk about, oh, we're going to go to the news sources and, you know, things that, you know, they're going to control the flow of content through the system rather than trying to reach under the hood and, like, start twerking at things, which is what they need to do, because Jack, as I said, has made at least $100 million in the last 3 months just off of the fact that he lets Donald Trump be as racist as he wants on Twitter.
Yeah, what isn't it, like, world leaders? They put out a thing, world leaders can't be kicked.
No, it's like,
Twitter.
State violence is okay.
Oh, yeah.
Any other violence
that's
is okay.
That's what it was.
It's terrible, but if, state violence and the fact that a leader of a state is advocating violence is somehow okay.
If you can. Yeah.
If you can carry out massive casualty events, then you're fine. If you just aspire to, you're a terrorist.
All right. Well, you can reach us on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis and at Green Weird, which is green_weird.
YRD.
WYRD.
Yeah.
Lost my train of thought. I'm Peter.
I'm Charles.
This has been Tell Me What to Think. Thank you. Be good.
See you next time.
Days of sunny, days of rain. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains!